I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 13th of November. Our guest this hour has written a piece in The Atlantic titled Let the Body Rest for the Sake of the Brain. He says that getting less than 5 hours of sleep a night makes people dumber and less able to concentrate, can also make people more susceptible to false memories. Not sleeping significantly disturbs our ability to encode information. The importance of sleep in classrooms, students who sleep more tend to be better at remembering what they've learned the previous day. And if we get 5 or 6 hours of sleep, it's also connected to the inability to learn motor sequences. So why is it that we're not getting enough sleep, and how does it affect us? Cody Delestrati is our guest this hour. He's an American writer and a researcher who's based in Paris. He has most recently worked at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and at the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, in Paris. His writing appears in The Atlantic, Interview, M, Pacific Standard, Matter, and NBC News. And he's currently finishing a graduate degree at the University of Oxford and is at work on his first novel. It's always interesting to talk about sleep. I'm sure we'll get more than a few phone calls this hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Hi, Cody. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll have a good conversation. So are people
I'm excited.
Are people in France better at sleeping than in the U.S., do you think?
I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that, but I think there's different sorts of work ethics between a lot of European countries and a lot of, the states in the U.S. So you do have this sort of trouble with sleeping because people have to wake up earlier for work and for school. But I do think it is sadly sort of a universal phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Well, this statistic that you cite is amazing. 1/3 of people living in first world countries required to wake up 2 hours before their circadian clocks or natural waking times tell them to. That's a lot of hours.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think it really just goes to show how school, classes, jobs, all these things are set rather too early. And sometimes it's necessary to have people go to work early. You know, if you're a stockbroker, you have to be up when the market opens, these sorts of reasons. But then there are also some other jobs, too, where you'd think maybe if we could push starting from, 7:30 a.m. to 9:30 a.m., would people be more productive? Would people be more happy, satisfied? And you really wouldn't be losing all that much. So mm-hmm. I think there's some sociocultural questions that have to be asked.
You start the article by talking about subway riders napping going over the Brooklyn Bridge as the sun is coming up. People are become pretty good at that, don't they?
Yeah, it really does become a skill, and it is funny to watch, too. It's all these, men in three-piece suits and women in business suits, and they're all just sort of sleeping away.
And yet they know exactly when to get up so they can get off on the right stop, right?
It becomes a habit, but the sad part is that the habit should be getting a full night's sleep so then the day goes more smoothly for them. But the habit has really become, or at least the one that they've fine-tuned, the ability to, sleep through your commute well. And you're lucky if you live in New York or in Paris or in London where you have a solid metro system or subway system, because a lot of times people in cities that don't have these sorts of public transportation have to get up even earlier because they have to deal with traffic. And then these are questions of should people be allowed to work from home to get more sleep, and you get embroiled in another set of questions, another discourse.
Mm-hmm. Do our bodies know from the research you've done when we have had a proper amount of sleep, is there a really big difference in the way we feel when we wake up if we've had enough sleep?
Well, enough sleep, quote unquote, is a difficult term because it really does depend on the person, on the individual. And there have been a lot of studies that have showed some people need a lot of sleep. Some people can get away with a little bit less. But I think universally between 7 and 8 hours is what's best. And when you don't really get that, as the Stephen Frenda study showed and as Till Ronenberg in Munich has shown, is that you have it interferes with learning, you really get impaired executive function, you have trouble honing motor skills, trouble learning, slowed reaction time. There's all sorts of seemingly small but it affects, but they very much do add up, and it comes down to a relatively simple thing, and that's sleep.
And you mentioned Ronenberg in the article. You say you quote him saying the practice of going to sleep and waking up at unnatural times could be the most prevalent high-risk behavior in modern society. That's quite a statement.
It's a huge statement, especially considering, you know, people are smoking cigarettes and eating lots of fast food and these sorts of things. So to say that, you know, getting up at 7 a.m. when you should be getting up at 9 a.m. seems sort of trivial, but I think it just goes to show not only how important sleep is, but also how, assuming we're able to change our job or whatever, it is something that we can really take control of. You can go to bed earlier. You can ask to work from home if you're in a job where you're fortunate enough to have that flexibility or that rapport with your boss. But, I mean, it's an incredibly important thing, and Dr. Ronenberg claims that it's the most important.
This may have profound implications for the justice system. I found this interesting that people can be susceptible to false memories.
Yeah. There's a rather growing body of research, relatively new, but most of it being done by Stephen Frenda over at University of California, Irvine. And there's just incredible amount of eyewitness testimonies that are incorrect. And that obviously can very much affect a court case when eyewitness testimony is very much privileged as something that can make or break a defendant's case. So when you look in, you say, you know, try to point out who the criminal is in this row. People oftentimes will misremember a face, they'll misremember the event, they're easily suggestible, and all these things can happen on their own, but they can be very much exacerbated by being sleep deprived, especially immediately the night before.
Do you think that this will have ramifications for the justice system in terms of eyewitness testimony? Are we going to have to find out what people's sleep patterns are before they give testimony?
I mean, I think in theory it would be nice, but in practicum I'm not sure if that's something that the justice system would be willing to shift to. But, I mean, it does bring up a huge point, which is, should we be relying on eyewitness testimony to the extent that we do, at least in the U.S. justice system?
Mm-hmm. The beneficial effects of sleep, you write about the classroom, that students who sleep more tend to be better at remembering what they've learned the previous day than those who sleep less. And students are notoriously bad about sleep and staying up very, very late and probably getting up too early. This should be given probably to all students when they're entering school, the first day of school. Make sure you get your sleep, and here's why.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it's sort of a two-pronged problem, and as you said, it's you know, the students' fault to a certain extent for maybe staying up and, you know, just watching YouTube or Hulu or Netflix or something when they should be sleeping. But it also brings to mind the question, and this is a question that's gone around a lot of public school districts lately in the U.S., and it's, should school be starting so early? A lot of high schools, you know, will start at 8 a.m., and that requires the student to wake up at, you know, 7 or 6:30 if they have to drive in, or their wake up time, their getting ready time takes a while. So it's really a dual question of both the student as an individual and the student as a part of the school.
Another fascinating part of the article was looking at people who had suffered a concussion. If they take a week off, and this would be very hard to do, from nearly all mental and physical activity, if they just completely rest, they can get better more quickly. And even if it's a month later, if they take a week and have complete rest, rest can be so good for us, huh?
Rest is huge. There was actually, I was just reading an article today, and it was by, I think it was a doctoral student at New York University at NYU named Ariel Tambini, I believe. And it was in the journal called Neuron from a few years ago. And it showed that memory consolidation can be very much added to and strengthened by getting rest. And then very, very interestingly, too, there's been more recent studies that show there's a sort of placebo effect with rest. So as nice as it would be to have the time to get a nap, you can actually trick yourself into having similar, at least short-term, positive responses to napping by just telling yourself that you slept well. So there was a recent study, and groups were split into two randomly and then aligned based on demographic information. And it was found that half of the group was told that they were in their REM cycle for something like 20% of the night, and the other group was told they were in their REM cycle for 40%. So group one was kind of under-rested, or they were told they were under-rested, and group two was told that they were adequately rested, while in fact they were both about the same. Mm-hmm. And the second group actually scored better on memory tests, scored better on questionnaires that were similar to IQ tests. So there's this really, really fascinating placebo effect, and I think, you know, probably a lot of those businessmen on the New York subway might be playing into that, you know, just sort of slap your cheeks and say, all right, I'm good. I've slept okay. I've slept enough. And then, you know, you hop out onto Chamber Street or wherever.
Well, that's interesting. Maybe that's the way for all of us to get by with less sleep, and we can do a lot more in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's nice in the short term, but obviously these things catch up because it moves from the mental to the physiological, and as soon as the sleep catches up to us physically, then you get real problems. But yeah, for the short term, you can apparently trick yourself into thinking you've slept more, and therefore not having these sort of negative associations that happen with sleep deprivation. Yeah.
What about this inability to learn motor sequences? Before you need to learn to play the piano, you have to make sure you get enough sleep. What other kinds of skills are associated, motor skills, with a good night's sleep?
I think it's really mainly fine motor skills is what happens. So as far as the research, there hasn't been a ton of in-depth research looking at why maybe people's react. It's why people's hands wouldn't react to their brain quite as much if they were deprived of sleep. But I think the idea is just you have sort of an impairment between the physical and the mental when you're deprived of sleep. And deprived of sleep, I'm defining as really, you know, under 5 hours a night. So really, not a lot of sleep at all. And what happens essentially is you lose these reaction times. You lose the ability to very, very, very quickly tell your body what to do with your brain. And it wouldn't be noticeable in most things because it's such a minute change. But if you're, you know, having to switch from piano keys one to another, then you really do see these things coming into play.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Cody. Cody Delestrati is our guest, and he has written a piece in The Atlantic, Let the Body Rest for the Sake of the Brain. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We take it for granted, he writes, but most people have to wake up for work or school long before they want to. It's somehow become normal that people wake up still exhausted, and anything but that is a notable exception. And yet, as we've just outlined, it results in problems for us. It makes us dumber. It makes us less able to learn motor sequences. We're more susceptible to false memories. So how do we change all of that? And obviously, there are some caveats here that some people don't need as much sleep as others. But when you're looking at under 6 hours of sleep a night, it's not very good for your brain. What do you think? Join us. Our lines are open for you. And whenever we talk about sleep, we get a lot of calls. So call early. Hope you're rested. So you'll be really smart. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to some phone calls for Cody. We start with Dennis in Oshkosh. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a 60-year-old man. I start work at 7 a.m. I work anywhere from 8 to 12 hours, and it just seems like the last close to a year doesn't make any difference when I go to sleep. After five and a half hours, I'm awake, and I cannot fall back to sleep, and then I'm fatigued the next afternoon. So is that natural part of getting older, or, you know, what causes it? Do they know?
Is it recent for you, Dennis? Have you always been thus?
Within about the last year, since I turned 60.
Cody, what do you know?
I'm not sure if I can advise you a ton on that, but I can tell you that insufficient sleep is incredibly common, and it often is due to people having to wake up early for jobs, and people just sort of getting a sleep cycle habit. But as for how to remedy that outside of the regular pharmaceutical choices, I'm not sure if I can confidently speak to that.
It is sort of this common wisdom that the older you get, the less sleep you need. Do studies prove that to be true or not, Cody?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the reading I've done, it seems that when people get older, they tend to sleep less. I'm not sure which direction the causality goes, whether it's people sleep less because they're older or because when people get older, they need less sleep. So that it's a difficult question, but I do know that it very much does plague a ton of people, and there's both, you know, insomniacs and hypersomniacs, the people are who can't sleep, and then people who have to always sleep, and both are obviously unfortunate conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just trying to set a good sleep schedule and sticking to it, having lights out, not having computers on, these things are sort of the usual tips as far as getting good sleep. But I mean, I understand that when you get older, I imagine sleep does get significantly more difficult. I mean, I know it's true for my grandparents. They read and do crossword puzzles at 2 in the morning because they're trying to fall asleep, and eventually they do. But it's obviously difficult, especially when someone younger is able to sort of hit the pillow and fall asleep. And I think the average is 7 or 8 minutes.
Is it really? Oh, I never get to sleep in 7 or 8 minutes. That's remarkable. Dennis, how do you feel after five and a half hours? Are you really dragging getting out of bed? Dennis, are you there? Well, I hope he had a chance to take a nap.
We couldn't help Dennis enough. So
no. Okay, thanks, Dennis, very much for the call. Maybe retirement is on the horizon, and you can sleep. You can sleep in. David in South Milwaukee. Hi, David.
Hello. I'm wondering how napping fits in. Whether you could make up for a lack of sleep by napping, and are you familiar with polyphasic sleeping?
What is that? I'm not familiar with that.
That is, you can cut your sleep by an hour and a half if you sleep if you take a nap for 20 minutes every 4 hours. So for each hour and a half you cut your sleep, you take a 20-minute nap every 4 hours.
Is that what you do, David?
Yeah, I've been experimenting with it, yes.
Uh-huh. And can you fall asleep when you nap that often? Can you fall asleep?
Oh, yeah, but I go right into a deep sleep, which is a sign of sleep deprivation.
Oh.
I'm awfully groggy after the nap.
Cody.
Yeah, I indeed have heard of that, and I've read about positive results to trying to just take kind of small naps. But one of the studies I was reading recently is, I think it's a 2010 or 2011, 2008 rather, study in the Journal of Sleep Research, and it showed that even just taking one 10-minute nap a day can significantly boost alertness and cognitive performance. So whether or not you're, you know, breaking up these naps so that you don't have to sleep as much in one go, or you're just able to grab the time to take one 10-minute nap, it will help you. So if you have the time and you feel like you need a nap, I would say take the nap.
Mm-hmm. Which may be correlated to this putting the body at rest, which we were talking about with people who had suffered from a concussion. If you're just totally resting, no stimulation whatsoever, you have to believe that it's good for your brain.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's not only good for your brain just in recovering from something traumatic like a concussion, but it's also good for your brain in increasing your ability to remember things, in becoming less easily suggestible, less persuaded by misinformation, or open to false memories. So there's all sorts of benefits to just taking just a brief nap when you can.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, David, very much for your call. We have lines open if you want to join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And what we're talking about this hour is letting your body rest for the sake of the brain. It's an article in The Atlantic written by our guest this hour, Cody Dell'Estrati. And he looks at various studies that show essentially getting less than 5 hours of sleep a night has all kinds of negative ramifications. And we're talking about what those are. And interesting to find out from you what you think about your sleep. Do you feel when you wake up in the morning that you're entirely rested and ready to hit the day, or do you fall into this huge number of people in first world countries who have to get up 2 hours before their circadian clocks or natural waking times tell them to? If you're in that category, what do you do to make up for sleep deprivation, and how do you feel it affects you during the course of the day in your work or in learning things? We would love to hear from you. Dave in Augusta sends this email. He wants to know if life expectancy is longer for those who sleep later into the morning and consequently get off work later, or wake up earlier and essentially get off work earlier. Is there any science that you know, Cody, about this?
I don't know about that, but I would imagine I do know that people who, you know, are tend to be less stressed are going to which is often a function of getting proper sleep, are often going to have less problems with heart conditions, high blood pressure, these sorts of things. So I think there's a lot of indirect variables at play, and it never hurts to get the proper amount of sleep. I don't know if there's no specific number that you can add. You can't say if I sleep, you know, till 8:20 a.m. instead of 8 a.m., then I'll live to 81 instead of 78. But there are a lot of ramifications vis-a-vis stress and heart conditions, blood pressure, as I mentioned.
And when you were talking about 7 hours, are you talking straight 7 hours? Because a lot of people get up and go to the bathroom one time, sometimes a couple times during the night.
Right. I think that in all the studies that have been done, because the way that sleep research is done, it's kind of tricky. Most is done based on self-reporting now, and in self-reporting, you just count it. If, you know, you fall asleep at 10 p.m. and you wake up at 7 a.m., even if you woke up for the bathroom twice, you would still call that, you know, the amount of time. But, you would call it the consecutive amount of time. You wouldn't break it up. But formerly, how the research was done was it was done through a DRM paradigm, which stands for Dees, Rotiger, and McDermott, who created the idea. And this was when participants for sleep research studies would actually have to be in the hospital. And so they would have electrodes on their head, and they would be in hospital beds and then try to fall asleep. And as they were sleeping, they would be examined for how long they slept. And obviously, this is problematic for sleep research because people aren't going to sleep the same if they're in a laboratory setting as they would at home. And the laboratory setting had the positive side of being able to count those times when you wake up and subtract that from the overall time you're sleeping. But the way that it's mainly done now, the way that all these studies I've been talking about, especially Stephen J. Frender at UC Irvine, is through just self-report. So the participants come in, they said, you know, I slept for 9 hours last night, and they're not really counting those crossword puzzle breaks and bathroom breaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go to Stanley in West Allis. Hi, Stanley.
Hello.
Hi.
It's good to talk to you. I've listened to you a lot on the radio, and I've learned a lot from you.
Great. Thanks, Stanley.
And your guest. I'm 76 years old, and I've had problems with sleeping, like a lot of the people have that have called, where I wake up one, two, three times at night and get up and go to the bathroom. But But that wasn't the only reason I lost sleep. It was because as I get older, I find that I'm more anxious. I have anxiety, and sometimes I would lay there and and think about different things, and that would keep me from going to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, my mother sent me a book years ago, and I found it, and it's about melatonin, the anti-aging hormone, it's called. And so I started taking one pill, a 5-milligram pill, a half hour before I go to bed, and honestly, it would knock me out. I would fall asleep, and I might wake up one or two times and go to the bathroom. Sometimes, I think there was only once where I slept through the whole night. But I would go to the bathroom and get back in bed, and the pill was still working, and I'd go back to sleep again. Now, I don't know if your guest is familiar with that.
Well, hello? I don't have a pharmaceutical background, so I can't speak to certain pills, but I do know that what melatonin is doing is it's entraining your circadian rhythms that we were talking about. So what it's trying to do is it's trying to rebalance the circadian rhythms.
Yeah, I guess one of the ways we get melatonin is from sunshine. We need sunlight.
Right, okay.
And this helps your body to produce. Melatonin is a natural, I'm not going to call it a medication, but it is produced by your body from sunlight.
It's a hormone.
Well, it's great that it works for you, Stanley. It's a harmless thing to take, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's harmless to take melatonin. It's a natural thing, right?
Right, right.
It's just a hormone.
I got it from a pharmacy at Target, and I asked him about it, and he said, yeah, it's safe to use. A lot of people use it. There are other things to use, but because it's a naturally produced in your body, it's, your body is already using it, but evidently it doesn't get enough.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right.
I would advise anybody to take it.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Stanley.
I'm not a doctor, but
yeah,
I know it works for me.
All right.
And I feel I don't have as much anxiety as I had had before. It seems to, smooth the bumps out of the road, I would say.
Right. It is. What is this tendency that many of us have? This happens to me a lot, too, where you're about to go to sleep and you're reworking something that happened during the day, or you've got some grievance, sometimes from years ago, that you're still working in your head, or some kind of, my dad used to have business dealings after he retired even, that he would work out and try to work out again. That happened 10 or 20 years previously, but it all came to mind right before you wanted to go to sleep. Makes it hard to sleep, doesn't it, Cody?
Yeah, it's funny how that happens. I guess, you're sort of closing off the day and your brain goes through and sort of tries to organize everything it has in it. And I guess all those problems and anxieties tend to pop up. And the thing about sleep and about its relationship to memory is that it brings up all these questions of identity and of who we really are, because if you're losing sleep and then you're creating these false memories, which can sometimes happen within certain contexts vis-a-vis friend as work, then you really have to wonder sort of what your identity is if you're not able to remember certain things anymore. And so sleep is just, just underline it three times. It's just incredibly, incredibly important, because without sleep, you oftentimes aren't as good at consolidating memories. Without consolidating memories, if you don't have memories, then, what do you have to a large extent?
Right. Thank you, Stanley, very much for your call.
Sure. One thing that I didn't mention, that my mother passed away. She was 87, and she had Alzheimer's dementia. And I can see in myself, like Alzheimer's starting, memory loss, and it's not just memory, it goes a little farther than that. But I think she had been taking melatonin. I didn't know about it. She never told me, but I know it certainly helped me a lot.
Have you been?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call. And he may not have Alzheimer's. I guess you have to be diagnosed for that. I think some degree of memory loss is natural, as we get older, but Alzheimer's is a specific diagnosis. Thank you, Stanley, very much for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Tell me more about the studies concerning false memory that you outline in your piece in The Atlantic, Cody. How were false memories implanted?
Yeah, so it's mainly FRENDA. False memories are implanted usually through misinformation tests or through suggestibility. So one of the tests that FRENDA did is he gave a photo, a set of 50 photos actually, to I think it was 139 participants, and the photo was of a man taking a woman's wallet and putting it in his jacket, a thief. And then to half of the participants, he made sure that they would sleep for less than 5 hours, and the other half slept for more than 5 hours. And then what happened later is in a misinformation test where he sort of narrated, gave a written account of the thievery, and he said that the wallet had been placed in the pants pocket when the photo had clearly showed it had been placed in the jacket pocket. It was 38% of the sleep-deprived group believed what they had read rather than what they had actually seen just the night before, while it was only 28% of the group who had a proper amount of sleep or 5 hours or more amount of sleep were not susceptible to suggestibility. So you had a 10% difference in suggestibility to misinformation just based on one night of sleep, which I think says quite a lot, because if we're going to be creating false memories, that obviously has a problem both with eyewitness testimony, as we talked about earlier in the show, but it also comes up with people's very basic belief systems. So there was another study by FRENDA where He looked at political leanings and those who identified as conservatives and were sleep deprived would be more susceptible to believing they had seen a video or an image of Barack Obama shaking the hand of Iran's president, whereas liberals were more likely to believe that I think it was George W. Bush who did something silly at a baseball game. They were more keen to believe that. So you have all sorts of fundamental political beliefs and eyewitness testimonies being implicated within this very basic problem of false memory as created by a lack of sleep or a lack of proper sleep.
Fascinating. Let's go to Rocky and Amory. Hi, Rocky.
Hi. I have a quick question. I was born in San Diego and moved up to Minnesota this time zone when I was about 7 years old, and I'm 52 now. I've never been able to adjust to the two-hour difference. If I
really?
Get up 5 or 6 in the morning here, I'm dragging butt all day long. Huh. Everybody says I'm nuts. I should just suck it up and blah, blah, blah. But if I sleep until 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, I feel great. And also, when I go back out west, I can get up at 5, 6 in the morning and feel great, feel fully rested. So do you think there's anything to that? I've never adjusted to the time zone.
I have no idea. I know that with jet lag, the sort of unjustified rule of thumb is about it takes a day per hour. So if you were going from San Diego to Minnesota, it would take you 2 days to adjust. But as for it happening for a multitude of years, I'm not too sure about that.
Yeah, it seems like you should have adjusted by now. Maybe you're just meant to live in San Diego.
No, they have earthquakes. Forget that.
Then you really couldn't sleep, so you'd be worried about that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've never adjusted. And once again, I feel great when I go back out west. It's
that's
like I never
belong,
left.
Yeah.
And everybody up here thinks I'm nuts, and I don't know if some people you just can never adjust.
Right. Well, thanks, Rocky. Thanks very much for your call. Val in Green Bay, hi.
Hi. I used to work for the railroad, and we had oddball hours. I was on call for 30 years almost.
Ooh.
So getting sleep was a major problem, not just for me, but for all the employees. And it was dangerous, you know, running trains, and then you're just not getting sleep. And then a lot of times when you end your trip, you'd be going to sleep when it's getting light. It was murder.
Oh, I'll bet that was hard. And you mentioned this in the article, Cody. It's when accidents can happen.
Yeah, it's very true because, you know, as much as it's easy to complain as a stockbroker going down to Wall Street and, you know, you're tired because you're having to wake up early, it's like very, very physically immediately dangerous if you're, you know, driving a truck or a large vehicle and you're very tired. So, yeah, it's absolutely something that you have to be even more conscientious of if you're in one of those types of jobs that lack of sleep can be extremely physically damaging.
Was there some reason, Val, that the employees didn't have the same schedule week to week to week?
Well, a lot of it was because when they got rid of what the public thinks is timetables, they were able to dispatch trains by radio when they were needed instead of on a certain time. And then there was also a thing called the extra list where employees would, if someone would take the day off or get sick or whatever, you'd plug into those things. So if you were on the assignment that did that, you never knew when you were going to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then you'd try to go to sleep thinking I'm going to, you know, in case they called, and then they wouldn't. And then you'd be up the next day like a normal cycle, and then they'd call you.
Oh, brother.
After you saw it, yeah, it was difficult.
I'll bet it was difficult. And that sounds tough.
And the companies didn't matter to them. If you had an accident, you should have had rest.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a catch-22.
Hmm. Well, and it sounds like the medical profession is well notorious for having doctors train and get no sleep at all. You would think, Cody, that companies would take all of the research that you outlined to heart and come up with what the proper hours are and what the best time is for workers to be on the job.
Yeah, and there certainly are companies that have more flexible work hours. There was Virgin Media just announced a flexible work hour. Patagonia has had flexible work hours for quite a while. A lot of media companies allow their employees to work from home. But when you're, you know, driving a truck or having to go do brain surgery, these things, you have to be there in person kind of at all hours of the day. So certain professions are amenable to it, but others, just based on the inherent nature of the profession, are unable to really shift around people's sleep preferences or sleep necessities, rather.
Cody Delestrati is our guest this hour. Let the body rest for the sake of the brain. He looks at all of the research that shows that if we don't get, let's say, 7 hours of sleep or more, everybody has a different need for sleep, but that many of us are getting maybe 2 hours less than what we need, 2 hours less than what our natural clocks, our natural waking times tell us, and it creates problems. It's more dangerous. It gives us false memories. It makes us dumber. So that's what we're looking at this hour. And welcoming your phone calls. Thanks very much, Val, for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls. Nancy in Mequon. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that this last weekend, I met a man who is blind, and he told me that he'd never had sleep issues until he lost his sight 9 years ago, and he has no ability to see light and dark. He lost, I mean, both eyes were just taken out. Mm. It's not that he has any vision at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's very disoriented, so his sleep became extremely disturbed, and he's depending on a medication that's helping him out now.
Cody.
What's the question?
I wonder if there. I've noticed on TV lately that there has been. You've probably seen those ads too, Nancy. That there, I'd never seen those before for people who don't have sight and who have problems with their circadian rhythms. Medicaid. They're trying to sell medication for people just like the person that you met. I had never seen it before. That would be an interesting study for somebody to do, Cody, and I'm sure somebody probably has.
As far as whether or not being blind reduces sleep issues?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. It's difficult to know. I would kind of guess that it's a spurious causality that this person as an individual just happened to sleep well, and they also happen to be blind, but it's possible and certainly open to research. I haven't seen any of the research on it, but and not sure it's out there, but that's definitely something that some budding doctoral neuroscience, sleep scientist should certainly take up. I think that could help a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Nancy, for your call. Jim in Green Bay, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
This is Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Are you there?
We are here, Jim.
Okay. This is a question, not a question for your guest, but I was wondering if Cody could speak on... I forget the name of it, but it's a circadian rhythm delay. It's classified as a syndrome or a disorder, although I like to think that some of us are just fire watchers from the old days. I am off about 4 hours from the rest of society, and I think the occurrence is about one in every 170 people. And no matter what you try to do to get back on, you know, getting up at 8 or 9, you can do it for a while, but as soon as you are allowed to, you will go back to staying up till 2 in the morning and sleeping till 10 or 11 in the morning. Till 2 in the morning till 10 or 11 in the morning. Do you have any knowledge of this?
Well, circadian rhythm disorders, you see this with jet lag, with shifting long-held work times. As for having constant circadian rhythm disorders that can't be fixed, that's not something that I personally know about, but I do know that it's rather common even for people without a circadian rhythm disorder to have these disorders temporarily when traveling across time zones or when having to, you know, wake up really early for a conference or something unexpectedly. So it's something that isn't terribly rare, but as for it never being able to be remedied, that certainly sounds difficult.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what did you do about work, Jim?
I was a teacher for about 13 years, so that sucked. I mean, that part of it, you know, but I'm basically a musician and have been all my life, and that tends to be something where people with this tend to gravitate to those sorts of, you know, policemen or hospitals, things that are all night kind of careers. But, I didn't find out about it until a couple years ago myself, and a light bulb went on, and I thought, my goodness, you know, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
So
I just wanted
to put that out there and see if your guest knew anything about it.
Right. Well, I was just going to say it's not a surprise that it took a while to get that diagnosed because I do recall there was a piece in, I think it was Sleep Medicine Reviews, and it was by a man named Dr. Yaron Dagan, and he wrote that it's extremely underdiagnosed because oftentimes doctors don't realize what's going on. They don't think that it's a circadian rhythm disruption at first. They think there's something else, maybe a stress factor, an anxiety factor at play. So it's very difficult to diagnose, but once it's diagnosed, hopefully at least you can work with it as best as possible.
Right. Thank you, Jim, for the call. Joanne in Mequon, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you, Joanne?
Good. I wanted to say that I have been a hospice nurse for a long, long time. And we go out and about to patients' homes or facilities. And if you're on call, which we are frequently, you're responsible for taking care of all of the team's patients. So if you get a call at 1:00 in the morning and you go out, and if it's a very extended visit until the nurse who is usually with that patient comes in, you have to leave there then and still see your own patients during the day.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with that? That's really, it has been difficult for all of us, being tired more often than not because of the extended hours.
Well, I think this is just kind of one of those instances we are talking about where certain jobs just require people to be out during times that their body would like them to be sleeping. And you see this with people who work graveyard shifts, night shifts, and certainly people who are on call, and especially in a stressful job like being a hospice nurse where you have to deal with extremely emotional events. So it's nice for people in professions or in courses who can adjust their life to their sleep schedule as best as possible. But if one chooses these jobs, then it does become very, very difficult. And I guess just slipping in these naps, as we talked about, trying to find some sort of sleep cycle, some sort of habit of going to bed at relatively the same time each night, and trying to just maximize sleep in whatever way possible.
From hearing a lot of the callers, it's striking to me, Cody, that people need to pay attention to sleep, that in terms of how efficient you are, in terms of the well-being of your employees, what you get out of them. And I wonder how many people pay attention to that at all. Schools, as you mentioned, are now, because teenagers are better at 9:30 or 10 in the morning. Some would say
at noon.
Other times. But I'm wondering if other parts of society are really taking this into account.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're running a business, you obviously want your employees to be as productive as possible. So I think as more and more research on this is done, and as it begins to sort of percolate down from academics into the realm of business leaders and managers and employers, then hopefully it'll be taken to heart. And like I said, it very much is at certain companies, but then there are, you know, these jobs where you can't really get around the hours that have to be worked. There will always be jobs that, you know, humans have to be on call for and these sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But just trying to maximize sleep when you can, and hopefully in these jobs where there can be a shift in times, hopefully, you know, business leaders are paying attention.
Right. Well, I hope you have a wonderful night's rest, Cody.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Kathleen.
Yeah, thank you. Cody Delestrati joining us by phone from Paris, which is where he is working these days. He's an American writer and researcher, most recently worked at the Council on Foreign Relations and UNESCO as well. He writes for The Atlantic, Interview, Pacific Standard, Matter, and NBC News. To end the show today, because we're in radio, we love sound, and I'm just fascinated by this. I wanted to end this hour with a sound we never heard before until yesterday when the Philae spacecraft touched down after this 10-year ride on Comet 67P. We're going to be doing a show on this next week, so don't worry. We haven't ignored this. We just don't have the date yet. But I thought we ought to listen to this sound, and then I want to tell you about an event tonight. Here's the sound. And everybody was surprised by this audio. They didn't expect it. Here's how it sounded. Never heard before. Next week, we will find out what in the world that sound could be. It's been a big week for space news. I also wanted to tell you about a program tonight with Colonel Chris Hadfield. We interviewed him about a year ago. He's been in space several times, most recently as commander of the International Space Station. He has a new book, Gorgeous Pictures of Our Planet from the Space Station, You Are Here. I'll be interviewing him tonight at Boswell Books in Milwaukee, 7 o'clock this evening, and you can get more information at boswellbooks.com. All right. Have a good night's sleep or a great nap this afternoon. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers.